The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and Summer Nights was like the conscious being of the book. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The American poet Wallace Stevens's evocation of the pleasure of reading, that familiar, curious meld of relaxed lucidity, meditative concentration, the body still and the brain a hive of activity, a path that has been argued to greater self-knowledge, more rounded intuitions, and even central awakening. Literacy is, according to the latest findings, in retreat. According to the World Bank, between 2016 and 2021, average reading scores declined in 20 out of 21 countries with comparable data, including high-income countries. What does this all mean, and should we be worried? I'm joined by James Marriott, Times columnist, and EI senior editor Paul Lay to discuss literacy and its uses. James, is it too early to talk of the dawn of the post-literate society?
I hope it's not, because I've called it that. And if it is too early, I'm wrong. No, I don't think it is. The figures you refer to are alarming, but I guess, I don't know, I find it hard to be surprised by them. We know that we've moved from this culture of reading to one of scrolling and screens. And I think we've all had a sense it's been a pretty dramatic thing that's happened to our culture in the last 10 years. I think it's sped up a lot in recent years. I think the obvious answer to why literacy is falling is smartphones, and I do think it is smartphones, but I think there's a sub-story within smartphones, which is that until 5, maybe 10 years ago, people were using their 21st century devices in quite a 20th century way. A lot of what people were doing on smartphones was still reading. People were on Twitter, people were reading newspaper articles. You know, a lot of the way that people used the internet, even in the early years of the smartphone, was to read news stories online. And what's happened in recent years is that sort of last little flourish of the culture of text has given way to the culture of the short form video, which I think is the future of our culture. And the amounts of time people spend on TikTok and watching short online videos, when once upon a time they would have been reading, even if not books, they would have been reading news articles. It's very unsurprising that we're seeing this, I think.
Yeah, the medium has become the message a little bit. It reminds me of Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, which came out kind of in the early internet era. And he's worried already about the way people are reading is changing. But his problem and his great point at the end is a beautiful chapter. He talks about how people are still reading loads. They're just reading kind of crappy things in short form. They're reading text, but they're actually spending all day reading. So he thinks, you know, there's a kind of positive message. If you just substitute that reading with stuff which we know is more beneficial, we haven't changed habits irrevocably. Paul, mass literacy is a very recent phenomenon in historical terms, even in the industrialized West. Let's go back to the 16th and 17th century. England, which is, you know, relatively prosperous, even then roughly 2/3 of adult males are illiterate and around 90% of women. And even that is a pretty rough guess. You know, that's measured by a thing called sign literacy, where it's if you could sign a marriage register or witness statement with a name rather than a mark or a symbol. How was the practice of reading actually perceived in that period? And when and why did literacy begin to pick up?
You're absolutely right about the difficulty of measuring what percentage or what proportion of an early modern population could read or write. And you've also got to remember that a lot of people are read too as well. So you can have access to literature without necessarily being able to read. And in a country that's going through at once the Protestant Revolution, the Reformation, which puts a heavy emphasis on the vernacular and the word of God in the language of the people who are listening to it. And that's particularly true of England, going back to the Levellers, the Lollards, rather, and translations of the Bible into the vernacular and Tyndale, and then made official during the Reformation. That period, and we see it in Germany too, it's a Protestant phenomenon and is very, very strongly linked and symbiotic with the printing revolution. That is the internet of their time. Mm. And suddenly, masses of people, not a majority, but more and more people have access to their own language. They may be able to read it. There's certainly an increase in literacy, but they're hearing it too. And they're hearing it again and again and again, not least through the liturgy, which becomes, if you think of something like the Book of Common Prayer and written in the King James Bible in the early 17th century, there are still phrases, salt of the earth, etc., that we use again and again and again, even now. They become part of the language. So there's that. And I think this historical take on literacy is an interesting one, because the first person who really introduced the idea of the dangers of social media, the internet, was actually, in my experience, David Starkey, who, of course, is a historian of the Tudor period, of the early modern period. And I did think at the time, when David said, this is the biggest danger to democracy and cultural life since the printing revolution and the Protestant Reformation, I thought, it's Starkey being hyperbolic, you know, he's being the provocateur. But the more I think about it, the more prescient I think he's been. You can't underestimate what happened there. It was a revolution.
And a revolution that created an infrastructure that then met the demand. By 1680, England had a postal service with 10 deliveries a day, so people are writing to each other. I guess that brings us to the era which is often described as the golden age of letter writing, when I guess, you know, in the 18th century, composition and actually inscription start to become melded. Yep. You know, people start taking pride in being able to write long, structured things to each other.
Yep.
Whereas before, you've got this, I imagine gentry would probably dictate, and then there'd be professionals who would take stuff down. It's also the 18th century, the time when you start getting national myths about literacy generated. Like, I'm from Scotland, and I was brought up with the perception that the Reformation created a uniquely literate society because the common folk had access to the Word of God. And, you know, I don't think it was actually in reality any more profound than what happened in England, actually. You know, but what are the factors there that begin to drive literacy, that start to make it something that's a point of pride?
Well, there's the Protestant Revolution, but then there's also secularism, and there's the rise of the novel. And the letters point that you make is really interesting, because some of the earliest manifestations of the novel in English, not just in English, but we can think of Samuel Richardson with Pamela and Clarissa, Henry Fielding with Tom Jones, they're epistolary novels, or that's part of them. And I think you've got three things that go into the making of what we now think of as the novel. I think, first of all, the father of the novel is John Locke. Locke's ideas philosophically about testing the senses, about trusting your own thoughts, are absolutely crucial to the idea of that self-examination of the novel, because he secularizes what had happened in the Puritan tradition of what I call the surveillance of the soul. Puritans, Protestants are constantly examining their life and their inner life to see messages that they are part of the elect, they're part of God. And this is secularized by empiricism, which also the third factor is the scientific revolution, where you have this empirical idea. And all these are very, very sort of English, British ideas that form. You can see why this has happened. And then you get another factor that I think is really important, is the novel is a form, for some reason, in which women excel. You know, immediately you have writers of genius. I mean, of course, you know, Jane Austen being kind of nonpareil, but there's a lot of people who are emancipated by the novel and by literacy.
Yeah, and I think that kind of that interiority you're talking about, I think of Robert Darnton's phrase about the 18th century, living cannot be distinguished from reading, nor loving from the writing of love letters. And, you know, letter writing becomes a sort of kind of source of feminine power. You know, the idea of the secretaire, the escritoire, the secret drawers, the social network that you're in command of.
There's a good point in the Ian Watt book, The Rise of the Novel, where he says that the novel is also to do with more complex capitalist societies where people become stranger to one another. In a more complex economy, people are doing a greater range of different jobs.
Yep.
And you just have much less idea of what your neighbours are doing. And in a society where everybody's a peasant, people are just much less curious about what the lives of other people are like, because
it's a kind
they're
of
much less different.
There, isn't it?
Which is very interesting. The point you were making about, you know, not necessarily having to read to be influenced by the culture of literacy, I think is a really important one. I mean, I think the best book on this subject, which is Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman, has a really interesting phrase, printed orality, I think he calls it, which is a culture of people who aren't only reading books, but are sort of speaking as if they are books. And you notice this endlessly in 19th century novels, where people give what I think to us in the 21st century seem like implausibly coherent and long and logical speeches to one another.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to assume that this is entirely the artifice of 19th century novelists. But I think that's partly true. I think it's partly the point that Neil Postman makes, is that people were just in a culture that was saturated by print to a degree that it's probably hard to appreciate today.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways that people thought and spoke were just influenced by print. And the thing that Neil Postman says is those values were incredibly useful to democracy, because long-form print encourages a culture of trying to piece together an argument logically and at length and proving it, much more so than the kind of broken, shattered way of communication and social media. It also has a kind of formality about it. Print is a much more formal way of communicating than social media or speech. And therefore, it sort of endlessly is this, obviously not always, because there's a lot of very scurrilous and angry print in that era, but the formality of print is always slightly cooling the political temperature, because people are always communicating in this slightly more formal way.
And there is nuance as well.
Yes, and it's just people's idea of what it is to communicate with one another is so shaped by books and so shaped by newspaper and magazine articles, in a way that our idea of how to communicate with one another is extremely shaped by social media, which is fast and broken and shattered. And we just, I just think it doesn't seem as obvious to us that we have to communicate in great logical paragraphs, in a way that I think it did seem a little more like that was how you communicated in the 19th century. It's how people spoke in debates, in parliament, I think even to one another in relatively casual social situations.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting experiment that I did, because you have almost the full archive, and that's of Desert Island Discs. If you listen to the way people speak from the 50s through to now, you see a real transformation. There's a great pride in being coherent and logical, as though it's almost rude not to be when people are speaking in the 50s, 60s, right up to the 70s. It changes relatively recently, where there's the umming and the ahhing, and there's these constant, there's a sort of lack of confidence in a lot of speech of politicians and political commentators. And I think this, you find this in that strange Australian upward inflection of not quite being certain what I'm saying. And that has happened quite a lot in public life, I think.
It's a really interesting point. I think the archetypal example of that change in speech is probably Donald Trump, whose rambling speeches, you know, he has this style that he calls the weave, which he, I think, likes to imagine that he's pulling together disparate ideas into this sort of complex superstructure. I think he's not. He's rambling from topic to topic in a totally disconnected way, which is a mode of communication that I think derives from television and especially social media. One of the points Neil Postman makes about television, which I think is a prescient one that was perhaps underappreciated at the time, is that it's a very disconnected medium. He's really critical of this phrase that used to be used in the news, and now this, where, you know, you transfer immediately from some sort of disaster in Haiti to a local dog has appeared at someone's birthday party and done a cute somersault or something. And Donald Trump is the product of the and now this culture. Those speeches which bounce from topic to topic to topic to topic, I think make sense in our cultural and media environment in a way that just wouldn't have made sense 100 years ago, because people weren't exposed to the disconnectedness of the modern media, which I think was introduced by television, is obviously archetypally the way that social media works. It's incredibly disconnected. And I think that's why Donald Trump works so well on Twitter, because there's nothing logical or ordered about his mind. It's scattershot, and that fragmentary nature of his speech just translates exceptionally well to Twitter.
Mm. And it's a kind of fractured language for a fractured society, really.
Yeah, I mean, his phrases are barely coherent, let alone his thoughts. Yeah.
Although
yeah.
I think the weave is an amusing sort of double entendre in his hair. You know? I mean, it's actually quite clever, that joke.
It may only be one weave going on there.
No, you're right. It's looking at old archive television, even the kind of bargain basement 70s, 60s, 50s politician sounds like Demosthenes. It's really disturbing. We are talking, I think, a lot about England here. Mm. And I think it's interesting that that's the case. You know, even in France, at the kind of high points of French belles lettres, the literacy rates were vastly lower than they were in England. And then you have this proliferation of technology, ideas, and culture that takes root in England, the Industrial Revolution. Paul, what were the kind of base factors there that actually drove literacy? Why would it become more important for someone to become literate, even if they were going to be doing an industrial job? Or did those factors kind of push and pull at each other and struggle for dominance?
I don't think you had to do it because you had an industrial job. In fact, if you read one of the great works of our times, which James has mentioned, the intellectual life of the British working classes. Is it Jonathan Rose?
Yeah.
An absolute masterpiece, one of the finest books of the last 30 years or so, which delves deep into the, as it says, the intellectual lives of the British working classes. It's an impulse that I think comes from the fact, again, this Puritan impulse, Sunday schools of nonconformist churches, particularly the importance, the overwhelming importance of a person who's largely forgotten now, which is John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress, as well as people like Defoe, we've already mentioned, who were dissenting figures who articulated a kind of spiritual nourishment that people wanted at first. That's the late 17th, early 18th century version of that, that becomes secularized through the novel. And there is just this great thirst for knowledge and hunger. There is a canon, remember, that working class people can think, right, I've been told Dickens is good, I've been told George Eliot is good, and they go and absorb this stuff. Whereas now, of course, we have a much more fractured canon. And don't forget that despite the fact that you're working probably 5.5 days at this point in really backbreaking labour, what we would think of as pretty, you know, arduous physical labour, there aren't many distractions. The English Sunday, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the old English Sunday, and I'm convinced that one of the reasons that Britain had that remarkable boom in pop music during the 60s and 70s is because there was absolutely nothing else to do on a Sunday. There was nothing to do, so people formed a band or they did something else. But I'm absolutely convinced that along with the old art schools, that's why Britain had a powerhouse. There is a lot to be said for boredom. And we can't live with boredom. And this comes back to the social media that James talks about.
Yeah, is that,
it's constant
is that
distraction.
Special,
we need the constant distraction.
Is that
we need
what,
noise
yeah.
all the time.
Is that what's special about the book as an artefact?
Yeah.
It's actually quite boring to look
peace.
At. It's black
you
lines.
You need quiet.
On, yeah,
you need silence. You need time.
Yeah.
You need everything that we are in short supply of. Silence and time. That's what the book's about. And concentration. Mm. And everything in society now, particularly with the rise of social media, is against that.
I mean, James, what's the character of... We talked a lot about, you know, societies where literacy is growing or a point of something people want to get. What about the 20th century, the kind of true era of mass literacy? What's the character of reading, of the kind of literate society we had or still have?
Yeah, I mean, the 20th century... In the 19th century, I think people thought of as the big... You know, that did at one point seem like that was the age of mass literacy, but it's the... School reform at the end of the 19th century, which really means that everybody is literate. So everybody can read novels. Everybody can, you know, go to the local lending library. And there's the canon that you talk about. There's also an awful lot of reading of what at the time you might have thought of as trash. You know, all the way through the 20th century, these huge airport blockbusters, you know, books 800 pages long, which are not great literature, but even the kind of lower end of that cultural environment is, you know, long connected thoughts, stories, concentration in a way that I think is just... hard to grasp for us now. And it's sort of amazing that culture of literacy lasted up through the age of television, up until the 21st century. You know, literacy was still very important. And it is the distraction thing. I think it is, you know, since the rise of the iPhone that it's really begun to decline.
It's interesting thinking about pre-literate societies. It's not literacy, obviously, that's a sign of power. It's orality, like the ability to command a tradition, sacred words, and the priestly caste.
Yeah, this is the point that Neil Postman makes in his book. Again, I mean, I don't know if this is still thought to be true by historians, but he says that in oral societies, an awful lot of social status accrues to the memory of proverbs, because proverbs are basically the way in which you can most efficiently store the useful information of your culture.
But I wonder if that tells us something about Trump.
That's where wisdom survives. Well, that he speaks in sort of aphoristic, aphoristic phrases.
He's commanding, and it clearly gets through to people. I mean, the weave is powerful.
Yeah, those little aphoristic phrases, I mean, they're hardly kind of condensed pieces of wisdom. They seem much more to me the product of a sort of shattered, disposable media environment than one which is sort of, you know, encapsulating little bits of wisdom and preserving them for centuries.
So, I mean, what does that tell you about who will thrive in a post-literate society?
I mean, I think we can already see. We can already see who the sorts of people who thrive in this society are. And I mean, the central point of Neil Postman's book, which I really think we are seeing proven correct in front of our eyes, is the fact that democracy isn't this sort of universal virtue that can be accessed by any society in history. Democracy is specifically the product, modern democracy is specifically the product of the incredibly literate societies of the 19th century, and all the values that it depends on, reasoned argument, logical argument, a relatively formal mode of communication that means that temperatures and anger can't get too out of hand. I don't know if you can have democracy without that society. All those things that Neil Postman eulogizes in his book are what are falling apart in front of our eyes. You know, the ability to reason at length, the ability to speak calmly to one another. And yeah, I think Trump is just so interestingly the archetypal expression of that society. And the fact that he sort of almost his career kind of tracks the journey that we've been on from reality television.
And best-selling author.
And best-selling author, not that he wrote his own books. And probably, yeah, I think there's a plausible case that Trump has never read a book, potentially all the way through. I would not be surprised if that's true. There's an awkward clip of him online where he's trying to pretend that he's read Tom Wolfe's book, The Bonfire of the Vanities, in the 1980s, when he's asked for his favourite book. But he clearly hasn't read it. And I think he really probably has never read a book, which makes him, I mean, the fitting emblem of our time.
But are elites trying to... It's curious, because you'd kind of expect elites to jealously guard literacy. And now, as a kind of point of difference, and you kind of see that a little bit, you know, Elon Musk tweeting about how he likes the Iliad, or, you know, the kind of big tech people are clearly, you know, they don't spend all their time on their phones, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that, is there a sense in which those elites are also being captured beyond the people who are super successful by yes. the kind of post-literate society?
I think there's truth in that. One of the predictions that Franklin Furr makes in another very good early book about the internet called World Without Mind is that he predicts there will be a sort of growing class divide about literacy in the same way there's a class divide about the quality of food that you eat. So, you know, if you're middle class, you're much more likely to eat food that on the outside looks very boring and unexciting. You're eating kind of, you know, granola and spinach and avocados and all this sort of thing. And if you're poorer, you have much less access to nutritious food, and you're eating, you know, we just know poor people eat a lot more junk food and a lot more food that's not as good for them. And I think he predicts, and I'm sure there will come to be more and more truth in this, what he says is that middle class people will, you know, become alarmed by the kind of intellectual slop and brain rot of our culture and be much more careful about what they expose themselves to. I think especially what they expose their children to. And I think you already see this, you know, lots of moves to prevent children from using smartphones until as late as possible. They all come from middle-class parents. And I think one of the really kind of depressing and dangerous things is that you talk about this culture of working-class literacy that, you know, thrived in the 20th century, is that literacy and the virtues that we've been talking about may eventually come to be a function of wealth, because you just will need to be a wealthy middle-class person to be able to afford the lifestyle in which you don't have to have an iPhone, or your children don't have to have an iPhone, and in which you can have the time and the energy and the money to kind of separate yourself from that stuff a bit. I mean, I don't have an iPhone. I have a kind of dumb phone. And part of the reason I can have it is because of my job. I mean, maybe famous last words. I don't think I'm going to get fired for the fact that I'm not instantly responding to emails while I'm in here. I don't have to be on the Deliveroo app or something to go and, you know, pick up my next order and drive around. A lot of precarious labor at the bottom of society is increasingly controlled by smartphones. And I think that could be an important social division. There's a phrase, sorry, I'm rambling now, but
it's increasingly cashless, which is again something which is harder to control and more easy to control.
Yeah, and the interesting phrase that I think may become more and more relevant, I think I once read an article and heard that stuck with me, is people who work above and below the API. And I can't quite remember what API stands for, but it's basically, are you kind of on top of the technology and using it for your own sort of purposes as a kind of free-willing agent in the world, or are you underneath it and you're taking instructions from apps and algorithms? And I think that will sort of be another divide about people who have control over technology, people who are controlled by it. And part of that control is the fact that you'll just, to be a delivery driver, you have to have a smartphone and your life will be tied to
it. It's dictated by it.
Yeah. Paul, do you see the other side of that coin? And this is the thing that makes me feel a bit sad. It's the kind of the wordiness, but increasingly jargonized language games that potentially middle-class elite people tend to use to exclude people from that world of literacy. It's a kind of artfulness with language without meaning that is not democratic at all.
Well, I wouldn't call it artfulness. I think this comes back to the laziness and a lack of conviction, is that people mask the fact that they don't really know what they're talking about through indistinct, jargonistic language. There was a perfect example yesterday in the Houses of Parliament, actually, where someone straight out of an HR department had come out with the usual flotsam and jetsam of language there that had absolutely no meaning whatsoever. And you see it a lot. And I think they're just hiding behind the fact that they don't really have anything to say. Or if they do have something to say, they're rather afraid of saying it. Because the consequences of saying the wrong thing, we know what can happen. And so within that society, what James talks about, this lack of nuance in language, has led us to almost fear that language because we can't have nuance. If we're seen on one side or the other, we'll be judged. And so that becomes a kind of horrible kind of circle of language that can't actually say what it means. And it's horrifying for debate of people not being able to say what they want to say.
I mean, there's a political dimension to this as well, that
we
live in a kind of very centralised, we depend on very large-scale bureaucracies, which I imagine function better if there are, within the bureaucracy, very high levels of shared comprehension and good literacy. I mean, think about all the miscommunication that will result in, i.e. poor spelling or poor writing or poor communication, if you're trying to create change in a system. So if you press the button at the top, I want this to happen, and then all the paperwork, all the communication. That seems to me absolutely crucial to some of the problems we face.
Well, I think the biggest
in the developed West.
The biggest fear I have is what James already pointed out, is this movement towards oligarchy, that we are moving away from democracy, and the abandonment of literacy, mass literacy, real engaged literacy, is the most profound danger to democracy. We talk about China, we talk about Russia, we talk about everything, but it always comes from within. That decline always comes from within. And this post-literate society, I think, is a profound menace to mass democracy. And who knows? I feel we're just in the foothills of this at the moment, but who knows? But there can always be a reaction and a resistance to this. But it's very, very... If you think about how long it took to create mass literacy and how fragile that was. And very, very few countries managed it without really appalling revolutionary political consequences as well.
And as we talked about, there are so many things that had to happen in a kind of sequence for that to be possible and for it not to be destructive. I'm now going to raise the kind of spectre of AI and machine learning. And I do think it does intersect quite closely with what we're talking about. And it kind of chimes with what you're saying, James, that API problem. I think for some of the elites, these tools will be immensely powerful because they're in control of the information. They already know what they're asking the machine to do for them. But then in a post-literate society where people are less able to manipulate and cohere large bodies of information and actually outsource that competency increasingly from a younger age, from university age, even from school age, to a machine which then spools out the information for them, where does that leave the kind of thinking, intelligent individual, the person who's not in charge of a country or just trying to get around life and trying to make sense of things? Where does it leave that person?
Yeah, well, I think probably an endangered species, to be honest. You speak to anybody, I'm sure you have spoken to people who teach at universities at the moment or who are at university, and the practice of turning in AI-written essays is like totally ubiquitous in a way that I think is hard for us to get our heads around as people who were at university before this revolution took place. And if you go through university and all your essays are written by AI and you graduate and you get a degree and you have, you know, a good degree, you have all the kind of outward impression of an intelligent, thoughtful person.
You have all the credentials
of an intelligent person, but none of the actual substance. That also comes, I think it's the, in a way, the depressing logical endpoint of the phenomenon that you were speaking about the kind of proliferation of jargon language. And I think one of the things about jargon is that jargon is a sort of substitute for actual thought. Jargon is a kind of verbal credentialism. By using jargon, you're advertising your educated credentials. And I think one of the, another, not to be completely pessimistic about everything, but another result of, an unintended result of the expansion of higher education has been that we pay much more attention to the superficial credentials of intelligence than we do to intelligence itself. The society you're talking about in the 20th century is one in which virtually nobody has credentials. None of these minors you're speaking about who go into their classes after work or are, you know, picking Dickens about the library. Nothing on any bit of paper says these guys are thoughtful or intelligent. That is not recognised by anybody really. But they are probably much better read and in many ways a lot more thoughtful than all kinds of people who are churned through universities, acquire the superficial accidents of intelligence, the degree, the ability to deploy certain, you know, jargon phrases in conversation to impress people. And the sort of intellectual structure of our society just seems a little more hollow in that respect. And that is something that you can completely see that ChatGPT and all these kind of other AI products will accelerate, because you can now go through university and have a totally hollow intellectual experience. Not only do you not have to read anything, which is, you know, a depressing trend in universities in recent years anyway, you also don't have to write anything. All you're doing is sort of picking up the credential and going out into society, and you sort of have this sort of slightly potential class of people who have all the outward impressions and signs of being credentialed and intelligent, but none of the substance.
Yes, we give far too much weight to that, I think. And I mean, the whole point about the diagnosis of the menace of jargon was that of Orwell, who did it more than 80 years ago. That clarity of language and the way in which that clarity is masked by jargon, because you actually don't know what you want to say, or you're unable to say it.
Or you have nothing to say at
all. Or you have nothing to say at all. And this is, that idea of credentialism is a really interesting one, because I think it has a profound effect on politics as well. If we look at just British history, and there are many other examples elsewhere, of really major players who left school very, very early and were not educated at all, of whom the supreme example would be someone like Ernest Bevin, or think of someone like Jim Callaghan. These were really, really serious heavyweight figures whose life experience was entirely different from the credentialed class, but was seen by that wider population that shared these beliefs, these canons, these ideas, that they were just as good, if not better, as those who were credentialed, like, say, the Macmillans or the Edens or whoever. Although, actually, probably it's the combination of the two that is best.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think this plays into the sort of anti-elite mood of our times. I think a lot of people look at politicians who superficially come from this hyper-credentialed class, and every single thing that you can learn about these people from all the bits of paper that they've earned throughout their academic and professional careers should say that these are incredibly competent, incredibly intelligent people. Actually, those bits of paper are pretty hollow, and all these people's pretensions to intellectual and professional superiority are, you know, as we've been saying, much more empty than would appear on the outside, and much more empty than they would once have been. And I think, you know, not to bring everything back to wokeness, but I think one of the sort of things that was frustrating about wokeness was that it revealed the hollowness of a lot of university culture, and the kind of credentials people were earning were not backed up by any substance. It was just a lot of sort of superficial language and superficial ideas. And
of learning what to think rather than how to think.
Yeah. And I think that is a lot of our anti-elite mood comes from the fact that people look at this class of people who are supposed to be superior. All the bits of paper say they're superior. Nothing but the in the way they behave or think. Yeah. Would lead us to think that they're superior.
The reality suggests otherwise.
The kind of sad thing about that is that people who probably would benefit from a systematic kind of education lose the kind of higher ends, long-term positive things, which are that sense of satisfaction, mastery, competence. If you've gone through a series of education that tell you you're brilliant, but you don't feel those things when you're actually encountering the world of ideas, or you've outsourced it, that's a crippling thing to feel. It makes you feel insecure. It's probably what you're grappling with, Paul, that idea of not really knowing what you're saying. And I was really struck, James, by your comment about the weave and this, what thought looks like in a kind of more audiovisual world. And I don't know, I'd like you to develop that a bit more. What does intellectual culture look like in that context? Or is it something we're already...
I don't know. I'm not sure that anything that would be recognisable as intellectual culture can exist in that context. I think what we call intellectual culture, which I think at a minimum has to be sustained argument that probably takes place in a book. I'm not sure how much you can have a particularly developed intellectual culture without books. I just don't know if we're going to have that anymore. Or at least if we do, I think it's going to be very marginal. I don't think you could describe anything that takes place on Twitter as intellectual culture. It's superficial arguments, people getting excited about fragmentary news events, overinterpreting them according to their particular political beliefs, and then forgetting about them again. An intellectual culture is one that is interested in, you know, sustained and deeper ideas underlying these things. But I think that as a presence in our mainstream discourse is basically disappearing, and all deep thought is just being replaced by kind of shattered, incoherent, perspectiveless events that bubble up and disappear and bubble up and disappear. And I think a lot of people have the impression that on Twitter they're participating in something like, I think a lot of journalists think this, and I'm sure I'm susceptible to this too, that they're participating in something that coheres to, people love to talk about the discourse. That is, I think, the term that people would now use for what would once have been called intellectual culture.
Yeah, or interiority.
All the discourse is it sounds, it's a, you know, it's a word taken from universities. It sounds like it should mean something coherent. The discourse is actually a useful and pretentious word to apply to the endless, mad, irrelevant bubbling up of fragments of pointless information that are scrapped over and forgotten within hours. Mm. And I think a lot of people have kidded themselves that participating in this endlessly updating, pointless news cycle counts as an intellectual activity. It doesn't.
But I think there's a huge sort of historical contrast with, you know, the various points in the history of the last 200 years, in the history of the literate society or within elites who are literate, where people say, you know, life has got over-rationalized. We need to go to more emotion. We need to find ways of revivifying the world through using symbols or romantics, German reaction to the Enlightenment, the folk revival even, which says, you know, we can use music to reinvest the world with energy and emotion. But all of those movements were completely dependent on literacy, on mastery of the canon in order to then reject it. There's a lot of chat at the moment about Bob Dylan with the film A Complete Unknown. Dylan is a really interesting example of someone who is highly literate and in his memoirs and in his public statements makes a virtue of being very literate, having read all the canon and being invested in it. But he's also doing something which kind of takes on what he saw as the kind of like investing more emotion in that world as well. But what I'm getting at is like, what are people reacting against if they then try and react against that?
Against what the sort of canonical
that bubbling up,
tradition.
You know, that kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I mean, it's totally, all the kind of reaction and reaction is totally meaningless. And, yeah. You know, something that people have been saying a lot recently is that a lot of university teaching at the moment is centered around, you know, fashionable reasons to reject the canon. But if you don't know it in the first place, well, you've got nothing to kick against.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, the stuff that you might learn at a kind of fashionable American university doing English literature is, you know, sneering and looking down at the kind of long tradition of dead white men. But if you don't know anything about that, you're kind of mastering the sort of empty knowledge that is oppositional by definition, but you don't know what you're opposing. And it's sort of this totally empty kicking into space, which I think you're right to say is characteristic of our culture.
And I think there's a lot of post hoc reasoning behind this anti-elite stuff as well. It's not actually anti-elite. It's that I can't be bothered with the canon, or I don't really understand this, or I just don't get it, or I don't have the time.
It's much easier to have a political reason to write it off than to try and master it.
Than to try and understand this and then critique it. Of course, people have done that. We were talking about Edward Said recently, when he was talking about the works, who has been quite radical in opposition to that canon, but he knew it. And I think the canary in the coal mine for me on that is the way in which classical music is regarded as elitist, because that is something that takes a great deal of time, great deal of space, great deal of resources, and a great deal of effort, even for the amateur music lover to master. And so it's so much easier to say, that's elitist. I'll stick with, you know, the pop music that lasts 4 minutes, 5 minutes. And it becomes a kind of post hoc reasoning then, not that this is actually elitist, I just can't be bothered to deal with this.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, it's a shame because, you know, the history of anti-elitism and suspicion of the establishment canon is a long and fruitful you know,
productive.
Electrifyingly productive strain in the history of, you know, our culture since the French Revolution. And a lot of brilliant writers and poets and musicians have come out of that opposition to the canon. But when it just becomes empty posturing rather than actually knowing anything about it, then what's left? And I mean, the Dylan example you raise is a very good one because it's an example of somebody who is, yeah, exactly, somebody who would not, at the time, he's become a bit of a canonical figure now, would not have seemed like a remotely establishment or canonical figure, Dylan, being a curious, intelligent person, mastered that stuff. And
he mastered the folk culture as well, as well as the kind of broad swathe of European text. And
he was part of the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. If you look at the biblical references and the classical references in Dylan, they abound.
And even though we might have thought of Dylan as a countercultural figure, those kinds of countercultural figures who people get into, I think, are often provide pathways to the culture that they're ostensibly kicking against to a lot of people. And, you know, I guess the kind of slightly depressing prospect is this stuff disappears from mainstream culture. People who are really vital, interesting people, and anybody who's a great artist is kicking against something. You know, there's no great artist who comes along and says, yep, the canon's all completely fine, I agree with it all, I'm just going to try and do exactly what everybody's always done.
Of course.
If those people disappear, and then you end up with, you know, the only defenders of that tradition who are defending it because they like how the way things have always been done are inevitably more conservative, more attached to it, and are just by their temperament less able to renew it because they like it because it's there, not because they're interested in it and interested in kicking against it. So you end up with people who know nothing about it and aren't interested on the one side, and people who like it but for conservative reasons on the other side, and are probably therefore unable to revivify it, and it sort of begins to become stale, I think.
I'd like to end on a kind of positive note.
No way.
How are we going to get there?
My positive note would be the kind of picture you described, James, which is kind of horrifying but very compelling, which is this kind of drifting from bubble to bubble. It doesn't seem to me like a particularly satisfying situation for most human beings. I think most people will be aware that that's not a good way to live. And potentially the shallowness of it means that that kind of deep literary mind, which was developed over centuries, which is within people's mental frame, it's whether they know it or not, probably changed the brain chemistry of, you know, your parents, your grandfathers, your forefathers. That is still there, waiting to be reconnected back into the brain, as it were. If there are neuroscientists listening, obviously, that just feel free to switch off. But you know what I mean? It's like it is there somewhere. And we were talking on the podcast last week about the use of classics and why people should read classics. And part of the reason people should read it is because people recognize deep down that there are, you know, shadows, ripples in your own kind of mental landscape, which for some reason connect to these texts because they are just part of the kind of broad swathe of how we got here. Once you say, I've had enough of this kind of shallow post-literate society, which is making us mad, it's making us less powerful, it's making us less able to hold elites to account, arguably. It's making democracy very dysfunctional. It means that our bureaucracies are also not probably functioning as we would want them. It probably means that businesses are less productive than they should be and not making the money they should be. Once all that filters through, and we talked a little bit about the backlash even to smartphones among middle-class parents, is it quite easy to throw off, or is that audiovisual society got its own kind of potency and its own, you know, vitality that will become clearer over time and become something that is just inescapable?
Yeah, I reject your positive note, I think, sadly. Yeah. There's an interesting piece in the FT about how people spend their time, data of, you know, surveying the amount of time people spent on activities they thought were meaningful. And again, you know, going to be so pessimistic about everything, but that has declined massively in a lot of people. Especially people of our generation, the generation beneath it, say that they are spending most of their time doing activities they find unmeaningful, scrolling on their phones. They say it's an unmeaningful activity, yet they're spending, you know, 8 hours a day doing it. And I think there is a lot of dissatisfaction. And I think, you know, there are all kinds of videos of even flying around TikTok of people saying, this is so trivial, I hate it, I'm wasting my life on here. But unfortunately, I think the thing that is very important to appreciate about big tech, and it's the reason I got rid of my smartphone, is that you're not supposed to win. You're not supposed to win against this culture of triviality and disconnection, because it's making an awful lot of people an awful lot of money. And every time you pick up your smartphone, which I really think you shouldn't do, and you should get rid of it, like, you know, not to say I'm so great for not having one, but it's the reason I got rid of it, is that every time you pick up your smartphone, it's you versus thousands of behavioral engineers employed by Silicon Valley companies to work out how to gain your attention. It's thousands of engineers who've worked out which app and which notification and which Google news page or whatever will draw you back into it. It's meant to fragment your life. It's meant to stop you thinking. It's meant to keep you on it so you can be sold adverts. And it's meant to feed you trivial, unchallenging stuff that you can spend your time floating around the internet becoming enraged and stupid, watching adverts and making money for big tech companies. I think it's a losing battle. And I think you can really profoundly want to escape that culture, the trivial culture of the phone, but just not be able to, because it is designed to be an addictive device. Mm. And, you know, not to sound like a complete sort of Luddite or conspiracy theorist, but I really do think, and I hope more people come to agree with me, the only thing you can do is get rid of your smartphone. You're not supposed to win against it.
I don't think it's the only thing you can do. I tend to be a little bit more optimistic on that.
Probably not hard to be more optimistic.
True. It's a low bar, I agree. But I suspect that the future belongs to those that are literate. I think it's so fundamental to the pursuit of knowledge, to engagement, to intelligence, that even if it's a small caste that we're dealing with there now, almost like a kind of priesthood or I suppose this is what Alasdair MacIntyre said in After Virtue, that there would be a new kind of Benedictine order that would preserve what had been established until times changed. Because I can't think, ultimately, when you talk of the lack of satisfaction, it does seem as though these tech companies are so hegemonic at this moment in time. But there have been many other companies and movements that felt hegemonic until people reacted to them. It must have felt very similar to, say, the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages, was hegemonic and controlled everything. And then there was a resistance to it. And that resistance came through literacy. And I still think that literacy, the reading of books, the deep, deep reflective nature of literacy, and I'm not saying this will happen, but it's probably still the only rule, the only way out of subjection.
Well, talking about another struggle, Bertolt Brecht said, "Hungry man, the book is a weapon." And I hope that people will see that it is still a weapon, and that it's, not to overdo it with a metaphor, but it, you know, it needs to be part of your arsenal.
It's still a means to power.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, at Engelsberg, we very much believe in
powerful magazine.
The word. The word is still the best way of projecting ideas, of engaging in debates, that's nuanced, serious debate that can change the world for the better.
Well, thank you, Paul and James. And saying that about the word, this conversation will be on YouTube, so do watch it as well as listen. And
yeah, I take back everything you said about the triviality of the culture of the video and the image.
And we want people to subscribe to our YouTube channel.
You can watch it with the sound down.
But thanks, James, for coming on, and thanks, Paul. And please, listeners, tune in next couple of weeks and subscribe to our channel. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Until next time, thanks for listening.